Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. This week we've had the budget update, and as expected, it saw the forecast for the deficit blowing out. It also revealed that health and aged care will take hits to help cover new spending since the May budget. Labor has said the figures show the budget is on the road to nowhere. But how would the opposition rework the fiscal picture? In our last podcast for the year, we're joined by Andrew Lee, Shadow Assistant Treasurer. Andrew Lee, do we have a budget crisis?
Michelle, I don't think responsible opposition should use phrases like that, but I do think that
we... Emergency?
Well, I think we need a government that is more focused on the long-term challenges of growth and inequality and isn't so caught up with just taking the latest saving idea that comes out of the bottom drawer. I mean, frankly, there's things in this budget that Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey rejected. This budget update really cuts deep into health, into aged care, into childcare. But it leaves on the table opportunities to make fair budget savings in the areas such as getting rid of the slush fund for polluters, not bringing back a $1,000 baby bonus, or closing some of the multinational tax loopholes. All ideas that Labor's put on the table that would contribute to budget repair without impeding growth.
Just to focus on the overall picture for a moment, could Australia's credit rating be affected?
We certainly need to make sure that we're making decisions that support our credit rating. When they were in opposition, the Coalition said that the principal test of economic management would be whether or not you could deliver a surplus budget. They said that they would deliver one in their first year and in every year after that. And yet, while the pre-election economic and fiscal outlook had the economy returning to surplus in 2016-17, the latest budget update suggests deficits as far as the eye can see. That then means that if you add up the cumulative debt, and when the government came to office, it was forecast to peak at around 13%. Now it's forecast to peak at nearly 19%. You can see why the government needed to do a deal with the Greens for unlimited debt, because far from tackling debt and deficits, they've seen them blow out under this government.
Now, we're talking about a return to surplus. Maybe we should say a possible return to surplus in the early 2020s. How significant is this? How dangerous is putting off a return to surplus for so long?
Well, the real danger, Michelle, is in believing that everything can be done on the spending side. So despite the fact that he's had significant revenue downgrades, Scott Morrison is still saying that Australia doesn't have a revenue problem, it only has a spending problem. Because we've got the most carefully targeted welfare net in the developed world, whenever you cut welfare payments in Australia, you make inequality worse in a way that's in excess of anywhere else. Our social safety dollars are well targeted. Taking them away hurts the most vulnerable in Australia. I think it's just unconscionable to be taking money out of childcare and aged care and yet not being willing to consider sensible proposals around closing multinational tax loopholes.
So, calling a spade, Labor is saying that overall tax needs to rise if we're to have the sort of services that we presently enjoy and that we want in the future. Is the downside of this that you hit incentive?
Well, Michelle, we've got a gap of about 1.5 percentage points between what government raises and what it spends. We believe you need to look at both sides of the ledger. I mentioned already our belief that you shouldn't reinstate a baby bonus and you shouldn't have a slush fund for polluters. They're spending measures that Labor would rein in. But we also think that you have to be looking on the tax side. One of the problems, I think, with the tax debate is the government in just 2 years has churned through three assistant treasurers and two treasurers. And with that level of personnel turnover, you don't get the long-term thinking about how our tax system ought to look in the future.
Do you think Australians are willing to buy the argument that we need some increase in overall taxation for funding what we want?
Well, if it's for the right purposes, absolutely. You certainly saw under the Gillard government when the National Disability Insurance Scheme was announced and a modest increase to the Medicare levy was proposed, Australians were willing to pay a little bit more tax in order to have a new pillar of our social safety net. That, of course, wasn't the only way in which we paid for the NDIS, and the budget papers talked about the long-term structural savings we would make to accommodate the disability insurance scheme. But we do need to make sure that we're always looking at opportunities to close loopholes. Saul Eslake referred to our tax system in an important speech a couple of months ago as being like a giant Swiss cheese. Too many holes in it, too many loopholes. That's an important perspective, I believe, in thinking about how we tackle tax reform in the future.
What do you think about the proposal that's been put by some Labor premiers that the Medicare levy should be increased to deal with the long-term health funding problem?
Well, it's an idea that's on the table, but we certainly believe that it makes more sense to first go to things such as closing down multinational tax loopholes. The government says it's got a multinational tax plan, but in fact, when you look at the budget papers, it raises no budgeted revenue. It's got asterisks there where a revenue estimate should be. Labor's plan does, though, deal with the way in which we allow multinational firms to deduct debt. We believe that there's one sound economic way in which that should be done, and by moving to that single test, we're able to add around $7 billion to the budget bottom line over the course of the decade, along with some other multinational tax measures as well.
$7 billion over a decade is actually not that much, and anyway, you've already spent that money with some of your spending initiatives.
We've announced certainly significantly more savings and additional revenue measures than we have spending. We've got not only the superannuation measure and the multinational tax measure, but also the increase to cigarette excise, which is both a public health measure, but also adds to revenue. Malcolm Turnbull, when he was in opposition, proposed an idea like this. Once he's come to government, he's poo-pooing the idea that we might increase cigarette excise. But Labor does believe that by making those hard calls, we can have budget repair in a way which doesn't make inequality worse, doesn't make housing affordability worse, doesn't impede growth and doesn't impede wage growth, all central questions to where the Australian economy goes over the coming decades.
Can we look at some of the specific savings in this budget update? Which ones does Labor at first blush think are a reasonable idea?
Well, we didn't. There wasn't a budget lock-up yesterday, so the first Labor saw of the documents was less than 24 hours ago. We'll go through our shadow expenditure review and shadow cabinet processes to decide on that. But there's a lot here that worries us, Michelle. A lot around the cuts to healthcare, to aged care, to childcare, to the Australian Federal Police's international deployments. Here in the ACT, we've got further cuts to the public service and to arts institutions, both areas where the government had already cut very deeply in previous budgets.
One specific measure that the AMA has been very critical of is the cut to pathology, the bulk billing incentives for those tests. Is there a chance that Labor would vote against measures like that in the Senate?
There's certainly that chance. I was surprised to hear Scott Morrison speaking on the radio this morning suggesting that pathology companies are simply profiteering and that this is a measure which wouldn't affect patients. In fact, you've had the professional groups coming out and saying that it could well deter someone from going to get a pathology test in a timely fashion. So those comments from the experts do concern us, and we'll be looking very carefully at that measure.
In general, how difficult do you think it is to make significant cuts in the future to deal with the expenditure side of the budget? Surely now you've really got to the bone.
Well, yes. I mean, in the case of the public service, I think someone appropriately described it as public service cuts as being a bit like an anorexic. No matter how thin it gets, there's still somebody who says that it can be thinner. The Australian public service is now to a stage where its long-term memory and institutional capacity is at risk, as Laura Tingles recently outlined in her quarterly essay. I'm concerned that that's the kind of cut that eats the seed corn, that impairs our future economic prospects. We need a serious conversation, though, around taxation. The Saul-S. Lake point about the excess of loopholes really makes you think that good tax reform in Australia needs to involve looking at each of these loopholes and saying, I know we put this here for a good reason, but is it serving that purpose? Are we getting the economic bang for the buck out of this particular loophole, or would we be better to close it, to have a wider base in our tax system, and so we can raise the revenue we need for the services that the community demands?
Of course, the loophole conversation, though, is the easier part of the tax conversation, isn't it? The central conversation, or one of the central conversations, is whether we should shift the tax system more towards indirect tax and away from direct tax, income tax and personal income tax and company tax. Now, that's a conversation that Labor is reluctant to have.
We're very happy to engage in that conversation, Michelle. People say we're not willing to engage in the conversation because we take the view that raising the GST isn't good policy. That's not a reluctance to engage, that's holding a contrary perspective. We believe that because the GST is one of the most regressive of our taxes, because of the risked growth that we saw, for example, when Japan raised its consumption tax and threw the economy into recession. But I challenge your view that looking at loopholes is politically straightforward. Every tax loophole has a special interest group ready to jump up and defend it. And good policy making involves engaging with each of those groups, each of those conversations. You saw in the last term of government when we phased down the dependent spouse tax offset, where we means tested the baby bonus. These were decisions that were attacked by our political opponents. Joe Hockey said that that means testing the baby bonus was akin to China's one child policy. So these things are never easy. But the loophole conversation is one that Australia needs to have.
Well, let me take you to one GST loophole. It doesn't cover financial services. Now, your argument about equity and hitting the lower income groups and so on doesn't really apply to that. Would Labor be willing to contemplate an extension to financial services?
It's very difficult in practice to extend a GST to financial services, Michelle. Talking to the financial sector, they speak about the challenges of breaking out effectively the value-added component from financial services. It's also effectively a tax on mortgages. So if you're concerned that housing affordability in Australia is at a generation low, that young people are struggling to break into the market, and that the United States is soon going to raise rates with Australian rates likely to follow, all of those things would lead you to imagine that driving up the cost of mortgages is probably a bad idea in the current environment.
So definitely a no-go area?
We've opposed it on the practical and also housing affordability grounds.
Turning now to some general areas, a year ago Labor looked to have a very good chance of winning the 2016 election, and now things have changed dramatically. Most people don't think Labor can win that election. Does facing Malcolm Turnbull require a revamped strategy, or is it a matter of persisting with the existing strategy and hoping the enthusiasm for him wanes?
I'd always thought that we were going to go into the next election as the underdog. It's been, as you know, not since the 1930s that an Australian federal government was turfed out after one term. And I always thought that the natural inclination of the Australian people was to give a government a second go.
That makes... It was very close in 2010.
Well, indeed. You can go back to 1984
and 1998,
where the opposition won a majority of the popular vote, in 2010, as you say. But in practice, it has been about 80 years since the Australian people turfed out a government at the federal level after one term. So we're the underdogs, but that doesn't mean we're not putting a range of ideas on the table. More than 50 this year in my own area. Think about ideas around competition policy, around the sharing economy, around multinational taxation. There's proposals on coding in schools around family violence, suggestions on the revenue side and on the spending side. So we've been engaged in that ideas conversation, and you can expect there'll be more of that from Labor over the course of the coming months.
But one of your problems is that this was dubbed the Year of Ideas, and you're right, a lot of policies have come out. But I think if you talk to ordinary people, you would find that very few of those policies have actually registered with the community. Now, what is the problem here?
Well, that's an ongoing challenge of political communication. You'd be well aware in this building that the share of ideas that come out from politicians that stick in the minds of the electorate has always been relatively low. One of the challenges for me as somebody representing the most populous electorate in Australia is to think about creative ways of talking with people in the north side of Canberra about the ideas Labor's put on the table. That's where town hall meetings come in, getting on the phone to constituents, standing outside shopping centres. You want to be out there with what the basketballers call a full court press, in every possible corner, whether it's engaging online or in person, to talk about the long-term challenges Australia faces and what Labor would do to address those challenges.
Well, if we just take a couple of ideas or sets of ideas, for example, it is true that Bill Shorten had a lot of material out on innovation, including his budget reply, coding, etc., well before the government, and yet the government gets all the credit. If we take another more way out idea, lowering the voting age, he announced that, and yet I don't think we've heard of it since that announcement.
Well, Sam Dastyari will be consulting with young people in forums through the first half of next year on the question of lowering the voting age.
Isn't that too late?
Well, it'll be a conversation that Bill and Sam will be leading to talk about an issue which is important to many young people. But you know, your point is essentially that when an opposition announces an idea, it doesn't receive as much publicity as when a government announces what it will actually do. I'm not sure how much we should complain about that. It is always going to be a case that oppositions are putting theoretical proposals on the table, which would be implemented only if they won government. And we shouldn't be surprised that the media gives that a little less time than when a government
a
says
a little less time, but the trouble for you is the media is giving it has given it virtually no time, these various proposals, all 50 plus of them.
And that's a challenge for us in our public communication. Anyone who's following my Facebook page will see over the coming days, we'll be talking about a range of those Labor ideas, using a different communication channel to have the conversation with the electorate about what Labor would do.
What is that channel?
A Facebook. So it's one way in which I communicate with constituents, being online, Facebook and Twitter. But I'll also be out there pressing the flesh and talking about these ideas as well. I got into politics because I care about ideas, Michelle, not because I care about polls. So I'm always happy to engage in that conversation about reform.
So what do you find is the most effective communications channel?
There's no single one. Everyone engages in different ways. People will come up to me after a town hall meeting and they'll say, "This is great. I'm so sick of having politics conducted in phrases, and tonight we've actually had a conversation in paragraphs. We've gone forwards and backwards between grown-ups, and if only politics could be more like that." Others will say, "I just don't have time to come along to a meeting. What I want is quick, snappy, digestible ideas about what Labor would do differently." 140 characters, and Twitter gives them that. So it's horses for courses.
As you move around the electorate, which of Labor policies are you finding resonating best?
Well, in the initial period, I think it was the power of our resistance. People were expecting that after a crushing electoral defeat in 2013, that Labor would be cowed and unwilling to come back against the 2014 budget. We stood the government up on a range of proposals that we felt were deeply unfair, and that clearly resonated with the electorate. Now being out there, it's a real plethora of notions. I was in the electorate of Deakin recently, campaigning with Tony Clark, our Labor candidate there, and talking about the impact of the GST and Labor's fairer ideas on taxation of multinationals. I was in Melbourne with Labor's candidate Sophie Ismail speaking about our sharing economy proposals, making sure that the sharing economy not only works for consumers, but also that we have appropriate worker protections and that there's access for all through the sharing economy. We have a range of great ideas, and as you say, that the chief challenge for Labor is to find as many avenues as possible to have that conversation with the electorate.
Of course, in a few seats, and certainly the Senate, you're fighting not just the Coalition but the Greens. Are the Greens becoming an increasing threat to Labor, or do you think that they've plateaued?
I believe they've plateaued. I think the Greens made a seriously mistaken call on the last day of this year's Parliament when they decided to back the Liberals on tax secrecy, effectively taking two-thirds of the private firms who would have been affected by the publication of tax information out of the tax net.
But they caught one-third in the net, and they mightn't have been caught but for that compromise.
The government's position was untenable. The government was effectively holding its own multinational tax bill hostage. It was holding a gun to its own head and nonetheless managed to fool the Greens. The thing is, Michelle, the Greens will never be a party of government. They're at their worst when they put power ahead of principle, when they try to get into the game rather than simply following what their ethics and their ideology should lead them to do. That was the beginning of the end for the Democrats when they made a deal on the GST, which ultimately spelled the demise of the party. I worry the Greens are doing the same.
How do you compare Richard Di Natale as a leader to Christine Milne?
They've got different personal styles. Richard's a likeable bloke and somebody who brings a different set of skills to the Greens. My difficulty is not with him as a person; it's with the policy decisions that he's made since coming into office.
Are you confident that Bill Shorten will lead your party into the election?
Yeah, absolutely. We made a decision in 2013 to change the way we elected the leader, and we were also had it driven home to us in no uncertain terms that the Australian public does not like chopping and changing of leaders. The changing of leaders brings huge instability to the team and takes away the esprit de corps that you get from a strong leadership team. You look back at the Hawke government, and one of the reasons I believe it was so successful was that you didn't have the conversations about leadership. You had everyone...
You did knowing, late in the piece.
Very late, sort of 1990, 1991. But you look at the engine of the Hawke government...
There were mutterings from about 1988, though.
It only affected the Hawke government in that final term, though, I'd argue. The engine of the Hawke government that ran through from 1983 to the late 1980s worked so effectively because people knew their role and played at it. Hawke told me when I interviewed him for my most recent book that he gave two instructions to his ministers, that they should get him involved if what they were doing had a whole of government effect or if they wanted him engaged, and otherwise they could run their portfolios. And that worked in part because of the stability at the top. So Labor's got stability, we will retain it, and it's good for us and for policy making in Australia.
Taking a long-term view, do you have any second thoughts about this system of dealing the membership into the election of the leader? Is that dangerous for the long term or counterproductive anyway?
Well, I think the way in which we've done it is right. I mean, the critique that you get, and which probably in the back of your mind there, is what's happened with British Labor, where they've had the election of a leadership who was quite unpopular among what we would call a caucus, they'd call a party room. We've got a different balance. We've got half the electorate being the caucus and the other half being the party members. I think that's the right balance, and I expect that other parties in Australia, the Liberal and National parties, the Greens Party, will look to come along with that more democratic approach to leadership selection in the coming years.
Andrew Lee, 2016 will be a big year for you and politics generally. Thank you for talking with us today. Enjoy your Christmas break.
Thanks, Michelle. You too.
And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for 2015. Next year, election year, we look forward to bringing you some interesting voices. Until then, have a good Christmas and New Year, and goodbye from now from me, Michelle Grattan, and my producer, Pat Hutchins.